episode of Reptile Fight Club. And as I hit record, the dogs start barking. How wonderful. Hopefully you can't hear that. Anyway, welcome. We're back. And we've got Rob here as well. How's it going, Rob?
I'm great. Yeah, great awesome. To be here with you and our guest tonight, Lucas Lee. Said he's making his Reptile Fight Club first appearance initially.
I never thought this day would come.
I'm very embarrassed by this fact. I, for some reason, I thought we had a show in the past, but I guess we've been on a few podcasts together. And so it's like,
true. Seems That's like true. We, it all blends together.
Yeah. I thought you'd been on, or I'm pretty sure we had discussions about getting you on as well, but maybe.
Well, it doesn't really matter the forum. If you're talking to me, we're fighting. So yeah, I can understand the confusion.
Yeah. But yeah, it's about freaking time. So I apologize for not having you on sooner, but glad.
Very happy to be here, fellas.
Yeah, glad we are in here together, and I'm looking forward to fighting with you a little bit. So, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
I don't know. I got Woma eggs today, so not a bad awesome. Way to not a bad sight to see. Although
my favorite sight.
Yeah, yeah. I did have a, there was like a little, it was kind of like a boob egg, but the little, the smaller part was separated and it had a little string between. And so I'm, you know, pulling the eggs and I'm like, oh, and I just went to pluck it off. And all of a sudden all the yolk started leaking.
Never pull the dingleberry.
I know. I'm like, what is wrong with me? How do I not think these things through? You know, why didn't I just leave it on? And it was one of the good eggs and it wasn't the best clutch. There were only like three good eggs in there and a fairly good sized slug. At least I think it's a slug, but I left, put it in the incubator, and I learned from last year. I turned on my incubator well in advance, so there's no spikes and evil things to kill eggs and disrupt the balance of things. So anyway, excellent. Good to have eggs on the ground. Happy to see that.
That
Sorry,
is
I just
excellent.
Was so excited. I had to get that out.
Yeah.
I think my womas are about a week behind you, so fingers crossed. And now I won't pull the dingleberry.
Yeah, there you go. Learn from my errors. Yeah, you didn't cut blackhead eggs, right? Or did you?
So 2 years ago was the great blackhead egg cutting debacle. And then last year I did get a clutch, but I was on tour and nobody found them. So I didn't have a chance to kill them. They died on their own. This year I might get another shot, though. Western is off food and looking good.
Yeah, my female's close to laying as well. She had her.
That's 3 years in a row.
I know she's a machine.
Dang, you're too good.
If I could only do good with the eggs, that would be wonderful. So
yeah, you and me both.
Yeah, last year I had that spike in the temperature and cooked them a little bit, and so the babies came out kind of wonky with small eyes or missing eyes, and I still have two of those. They're still going, going along. They still require me to help them out a little bit, put a rodent in their mouth and hold still and let them figure out that it's food. So they're doing okay, but still a little bit of the hair pulling out stage, you know, trying to spit it out every chance they get. Just
Morph Market tells me that you should post those up. That seems like today's drama. Maybe we can fight about that in the future. That should be your next posting.
Yeah.
I don't even know about this.
I'm really like conflicted what to do with them. Like just give them to somebody or to.
Well, we'll have to fight about it, you know, because again, today's, I guess someone had posted on Morph Market. I didn't even see it, but several people were sending it around. There were plenty of agitated Facebook posts about like there was a split lip, one eyed Xanthic water monitor that someone was pitching on there, you know, didn't include the price or whatever, and all that. So we can talk about that because I do see two sides to that, notably on both the price wasn't included. So, and I believe the ad's been pulled. The seller's been banned. You know, there's plenty there. Well,
of course. Yeah.
In the future. So
yeah.
When in doubt, ban, it out.
Yeah, exactly.
So, yeah. Well, we can talk about that later.
Yeah. I've had baby, you know, blue tongue skinks, northern blue tongues that have been, you know, born with, you know, slight kinks or something like that. And I'll just give them to somebody. I actually gave one to my cousin's kid and she made like an Instagram for it, you know, and like took really good care of it. And it had more followers than I did, you know, it's like a very popular little special needs skink. So
Well, I mean, my point would be accepting the potential price point, which, as I say, I didn't see, not something that I'm looking into or whatever. Accepting the price point, really, then anyone who's saying that that's problematic is advocating that it should be euthanized. So to me, that's sort of the, like, if you look at it, that dichotomy, maybe that's what we can talk about in a future episode. Yeah. Is, you know, from my perspective, anyone who's saying absolutely that that's wrong, that that should be available, again, price notwithstanding, that's what they're saying. So if it's not perfect, then you got to euthanize it. So, hey, that's pretty heavy.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Well, I mean, what's,
and I don't know that people are realizing that that's what they're saying when they're taking that approach, but that's how it, at least someone could read it. So that's why I say, I think there maybe there's something there to talk about. More complicated.
I think should be the most expensive reptile on Morph Market. All those broken genes, all those mutations.
I know.
That's a world's first.
Dolphin head out of this, you know?
Maybe so. Right.
Yeah.
So
probably codon.
Neither here nor there, but. Right. Anyway, after I've derailed that enough.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I just watched a YouTube video with the Payne's Python. Oh, what's it?
Pythons Payne. And lizards or whatever. Yeah.
The extreme herping guys. That's the channel. Yeah, extreme herping, and they were out in the Brigalow Belt and found
that
like inland carpet.
No.
Michael Payne and
Different one.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
Oh, I can't recall. I'm terrible with names, but anyway, the other guy that he herps with too, but it was, I think it was Michael this time, and I'm hoping I'm getting his name right. but anyway, yeah, I'm great at this. Anyway, they found an inland carpet out, near.
Oh, sweet.
Which was pretty. It was nice. It was something that I would like to see someday. So,
right?
Yeah, yeah.
That's fantastic.
I'll have to check that one out. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, it's pretty neat. It's towards the end of the video. He spends a lot more time on the elapids than he does on the inland carpet. I'm like, come on! You get 5 seconds for the inland, and like, you know, he's following around a mulga for like, you know, 15 minutes or something.
That's funny.
I'm exaggerating, of course, but yeah, mulgas are fun. I don't fault him for that, but show a little bit
the
more.
The female inland that I got from you is getting really red. I'm stoked on her.
Nice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's like, nice
such
one.
Awesome snakes. Yeah.
They are.
Yeah. I'm a little dubious I'll get eggs this year from my females. I haven't really seen much.
You did too good last year. They need to humble you.
I guess. I didn't do that great last year either.
I thought you had like 3-4 clutches.
No, I just had one clutch last year, and that it was the year before that I had two. I think it was the year before that. Yeah. Anyway,
I take it back.
I know I suck, but
they're just always humbling you.
Yeah,
exactly. But you know, it is what it is. I guess they
really.
I really need to probably get some new caging, get some, you know, just improve things overall. I've got some kind of janky stuff going on, like, you know, just like old stuff that I've had for a while, and I just haven't taken the time to make new caging and get that squared away. I just need to get out there and do it. I keep using that as an excuse to buy new tools, and then I buy the tools, but I don't use them to build the caging. So I need to just make that happen. But yeah, it's, if it's not, I don't know, if it takes too much time, it usually gets put on the back burner, you know, so I'm like, stupid.
You're a busy guy.
Yeah. What do you do? I did learn from the chat about that cement, hydraulic cement. I'm kind of excited about that. It's like fast drying and strong. It won't chip as easily. So I'm going to try that out for some fake rock work and see if that helps me get excited about it. I got some of these cheap, like stacking, they're like front opening stackable things. And you know, just shelves or whatever. And they're perfect size for Antaresia. And I just want to do some like fake rock work and kind of, but I need a way to keep them closed because they have kind of a magnetic close, but it's not strong enough to keep a snake from pushing the door open if it wanted to. And so I need to figure that out and, you know, get to find a good way, probably put some heat cable under the fake rock or something and do something cool.
Ah, DIY heat rocks.
Yeah, exactly. That's what could go wrong, right?
DIY, whatever.
Yeah. Yeah. DIE maybe if it goes the wrong way. Yeah. I thought about using them for the knobtail geckos too. So maybe that would be a better plan because they're not going to push the doors open. But I saw you're breeding an AMIA. You're bidding on an AMIA. So,
I've got
a couple males if you want one of them.
It was ill advised. I didn't have the money to spend on it, but I was trapped in a car and it looked cheap and pretty. So,
yeah, we find ourselves in those situations.
But someday that is a species I would love to work with.
Oh, they're fun.
Very Pokemon esque.
Yeah. I picked up a pair of Asper, the, I don't even know the common name.
I don't either, but I know what you're talking about.
So, they're doing good. They're pretty cool. I've got one white male and a black female. So we'll see.
Sweet.
See what I can get out of those guys. They're pretty cool. But that's always been a dream species for me. And they've always been really difficult for people. But I was talking to some guys at Tinley and they're like, oh man, figured it out. I started producing a bunch of them and they're doing great. And here's the secret. I'm like, okay, well maybe I'll try it out. Plus the price about was in half from what it has been previously. So that helped a lot.
Yeah, no doubt. That's awesome. Crazy. I mean, those are really fantastic. Yeah. It's really a dream. Both. I mean, AMIA, Asper, Shea, all that stuff, that look truly, you know, so alien and whatever.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
Sentient rocks.
Yeah. The AMIA are my favorite geckos. They're so cool. And that's what I'm hoping to find on the big 50th trip. So save up your money there, Lucas. You got to join us out there in Central.
I would love to
go find a Centralian.
That's right.
To live up to your namesake.
Right? I feel like nobody that I talked to in the NPR world has found one since Casey Cannon. Yeah. Back in like 2018 or whatever. So we're due as a group.
Yeah, right. Has anybody been out there looking? Oh, I guess
I don't know.
Matt was out there.
It does help to look.
Had Matt on the podcast and he didn't see a Centralian, but that's a high one on my list. And speaking of which, I really enjoyed that show with Gavin. Eric sent me.
Yeah, it was great. Truly. Yeah. Truly great to have him, you know.
He's a funny guy.
Just going to do a standard Student of the Serpent or whatever. And, you know, it was great then to, I mean, essentially we had, it is more or less the same conversation we had had in, November 1st, 2019 or whatever, when we were eating croc parm and all in Darwin. So, yeah, it was pretty cool. And then before the first time I held an Oempele python in the Darwin Botanical Gardens. So that was something, hey?
That's awesome.
But... yeah, no, that was really good. He did awesome, and it was great to get a chance to have him share so much of that stuff in a public space.
Yeah, I always enjoy listening to his shows. He was on the Aussie Wildlife Show, and that was a great episode as well.
Yeah,
it's just really fun.
I feel like we went a little bit longer, and kind of maybe into a little bit additional depth or whatever, because that was I don't think it's still going at this point, but it was a little bit the perspective obviously is a little bit different. But that was really good. And that was basically the only other one beforehand, I think. So,
yeah, there was one other, I think. But yeah, anyway, he's really enjoyable to listen to. I've hung out with him a couple times. Like he was at the one of the symposia that I was at. And also we had a dinner with him at one point and I sat by him at dinner. It was really, I mean, he's just a wealth of knowledge and I'm really excited to get together with him again and pick his brain. And because when we were in Darwin, we had one of those issues with the guy who put on the symposium was a dirtbag. Right. And so everybody kept their distance from us because of him, because we were coming to his symposium. So therefore we were also dirtbags. You know, it was like, we didn't know he was a dirtbag. We don't know. We just wanted a free trip to Australia to come and talk about reptiles. You know, we didn't care. But I mean, in retrospect, we did care because that dirtbag left me stranded in Darwin and I didn't, you know, but anyway, I think, Gavin did, hang out or was welcomed us to Crocosaurus Cove. He wasn't there on the day I was there. And then when I found out I was being swindled, the organizer of the symposium stole my books and left me stranded in Darwin. Jeez. And so I was trying to figure out how to get out of there. And And so Nick and I didn't go to Crocosaurus Cove and watch Rico and Mark swim in the Cage of Death. And we kept teasing and saying they had to go into Amplexus while they were in the Cage of Death. That was kind of the running joke, but they didn't do it, those wimps. So anyway, yeah, we missed out on that, which was kind of crappy. So I feel bad about
that. You get swindled and stranded in unknown lands. I think there's a bit of leeway there for plans not going right.
I was being kind of stubborn. I'm like, fine, I'm just going to stay here. I'm going to stay in Darwin.
You didn't leave me here. I left me here.
I stayed my own free volition. But,
well, it gave you those books. The negative experiences of your first trip will just be building that much good credit towards when we go in the fall. So that would be the hope, I guess, on my end.
And I wonder too if that was kind of one of the reasons I wasn't really excited to go back there. I wonder if that might have been kind of subconsciously what was keeping me from it. It's like I just had such negative feelings there, you know. It's like I don't want to go, but yeah, obviously that won't happen again.
Hey, maybe a little Shay Eye before the AMI. That'd be all right. You probably wouldn't be complaining too much, I'd guess.
Yeah, exactly. If we can target those, that would be fantastic. And I'm sure, you know, we'll be in the right places.
Know the spot. We've been on the spot and all that. And,
I think Ryan Young saw a Shay out there. Guys didn't see one, did you?
No. So I think there are a couple of spots that are close to where we were on, as I say, on a spot that definitely suits it and where they're found and things, but not at night. We were at a different place at that time. So it would have been exceedingly unlikely, you know, to see one in that context. So, no, but I'd be excited to.
Yeah.
And what are the big cave geckos up there? Those are really cool.
Yeah, I'd like to see those too. We saw an Oidura gemata, like the jeweled velvet gecko that was pretty sweet.
Yeah, all that. All those geckos up there are pretty cool for the most part. Maybe you've seen a couple, couple gyra. You've seen them all, but other than that, you know.
Yeah, I'm really excited though to get back up there and try for some of those things that I missed on the first trip. I mean, we had a pretty good trip. We found a Darwin carpet the first night in the area, you know, and found an olive and a blackhead and all these cool things. So
blackhead,
yeah,
a breechy, which is no longer a breechy. Apparently they sunk those into Acanthurus, but they're really cool with that bright yellow throat. And this one was kind of crazy looking to me, at least. I think a couple Australians are like, they look like that around here. So, but
Is cool that trip. This year?
That top ender form or whatever?
No, that's this year's with Rob and Eric in Darwin. Yeah. And then the 50th is going to be Central Australia. So
is that 2025?
2025.
Gotcha. All right.
Yeah. Born in 75. So all the fives are my 0 years.
Ooh, that's easy.
Yep. Yeah.
Nice.
So turning 50, it's kind of crazy, but hopefully it'll be a very good birthday. Lots of good stuff. And I did ask, I talked to Gab because, him talking about his research reminded me, he's the one to ask about Bredelai and where to go for those. So, I'm excited to pick his brain. But he said March would be a good time to be looking for Bredelai. So
awesome.
See what happens. He said September or March. So we'll see.
Epic.
Yeah. If March.
I guess we can make that work.
Yeah.
Just do both.
Yeah, there you go. I've always wanted to drive from Midnight Oil Song. They say Darwin down to Alice Springs, and so I thought someday I'm going to do Darwin down to Alice Springs, and that's what Matt did. Matt Teachin, so he beat me to it. But that's not
sounds
a
like
trip,
a Justin
though.
Style trip.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, not Rob style, but yeah,
that's all right though. One funny humorous bit associated with sort of we've now done a half dozen of these since Chuck had to take a step back. And I think mostly it was my internet, and certainly sort of the holiday, as exemplified on the holiday show. Hopefully it sounds better, maybe not perfect, but better so far. But that point was taken that I've now had two different people send me a microphone to utilize when recording this podcast. I have yet to actually effectuate that and get it set up and whatever. Not from lack of appreciation, but I will do that. But yeah, it's just been a timing thing, been running crazy and all that. But yeah, that was pretty darn funny. Two people, not unbeknownst to one another, said, "Hey, hey," and I don't know what's, you know, if they got a head injury or whatever, but they're happy with the content, but they wish it sounded a little bit
they
better.
They actually want to hear what you have to say.
Yeah, weird enough. So I think it was mostly the internet, but two different microphones showed up at my house. So that was pretty funny.
Yeah. Well, hopefully you can put them to use soon. Yeah.
Yeah, you can use both at the same time, set up stereo and do surround sound.
Yeah.
That'll be wild. People don't need that, but maybe that's what they want.
They'll have a Rob Stone overload. They'll be like, it's too perfect, and their heads will explode.
I feel like that's probably, it's already probably way too much, but there we go. So I did want to toss that out there. So thank you.
That's what it really means to get stoned.
There you go. Excellent. I will say though, with the Owen Pelly show, you asked some wonderful questions that I was hoping that would be asked him. So yeah, thank you for chiming in there and getting your
gotta cut Owen off more. We're robbed.
No, but they were very like just the best questions you could ask. So yeah, that was, I think you're really tuned into those kind of things and do ask great questions and make great points. So I'm very happy you're on this podcast as well. So
all good. Well, lots of fun, but yeah. So thank you, Phil. Thank you, Rob Christian.
Ah, excellent.
Yeah. Rob contacted me. He's like, I want to send him a microphone. can I send it to you? And you send it to him. And I said, well, how about I just give you his address and then you can send it yourself directly. He's like, yeah, that works. I wanted it to come from him, not from, you know, from me. So yeah, that was, yeah, he's a nice guy.
What are you saying, Justin?
No, both Rob and Phil are about the best kind of people you could be around. So yeah, they're good guys.
100%.
Yeah. They make me think I need to be a better person. That's the, like, I'm thinking, what? I need to start gifting people things. You know, on the last trip when Nipper gave us the book signed by,
the European, field guide. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Attenborough. Well, no, the,
that was the one before. Yeah. All these different things. Yeah. I think that's really
I wasn't
great.
On the Florida one with you guys, so I missed out on that one. But yeah, just makes me think, man, I need to be a better person. Like bring gifts to Herb Trips. Keith and Teresa also brought like shot glasses that were engraved with, you know,
that's awesome.
I think our names on them or something. Yeah. It was really nice. Really thoughtful. So makes me want to be better. And then we get to the next trip and I'll be like, oh crap, I got to leave in 3 days. What crap can I give these guys? Here's a Slim Jim. Enjoy.
Everybody gets a Lake Chapala garter snake, baby.
Yeah. Lucas has a Tupperware. We're like, run. He's going to try to give us a garter snake.
It's been known to happen.
Oh man. Yeah. That's, Shweez-tastic, man. Those garter snakes. there's awesome some cool stuff. Garter snakes. I will admit that. I do want to go find that really weird one down in Arizona, the narrow headed or whatever.
That'd be cool. On the rim. For sure. Yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah. I'm actually headed down to the Grand Canyon. So my daughter, she wanted to do a canyoneering trip kind of for her spring break. And so I'm like, yeah, I could arrange that. My buddy down in Phoenix is just, he's the man when it comes to that stuff. And so I'm like, hey, we want to come down to Phoenix and do some canyoneering. He's like, what do you think about the Grand Canyon? Would you want to do a trip down? I'm like, you can canyoneer in the Grand Canyon? Sign me up. Like, heck yeah. So we're going to try to do that. He said, unless it rains, because the pools and stuff are like this clear blue color. And if it rains, then they get all muddy and gross. So he's like, you want to go 2 weeks at least after rain. So we're going to kind of play it by ear as we get closer, but we're going down there at the end of the month. And
that sounds amazing. We'll
do something in the Grand Canyon. I might have to preempt our trip stuff. And exactly. Find something down there. And my dad's like, I think that's on the South Rim. And I was thinking, well, we're coming kind of from the north, so I don't recall us going, you know, underneath the,
all the
and
way around.
It turns out it's like on the east rim or whatever, you know, because it kind of curves up and around, and it's on Navajo land, so you have to get a permit from the Navajo Nation to go down there. But hopefully it works out. I'm excited. My daughter's excited. So, and all my other daughters are all mad. They're like, Dad, you know, we want to go to the Grand Canyon. You've never taken us there. I'm like, okay, well, we've done like three trips to like Southern California to go to the beach. You could have said one of those trips, you want to go to the Grand Canyon, but I've never heard you say it that emphatically. Right. So yeah, but I guess we got to take them all to the Grand Canyon. But then I'm like, you guys want to go canyoneering? They're like, no. But we want to go to the Grand Canyon. I'm like, okay, fine. Yeah, I ruined very a few cool. of them with my misadventures, but what do you do? They don't like to camp.
They're either anymore. Super in or super out, right, at this point? Yeah.
This daughter is probably forgotten because she was somewhat younger, so she forgot the
Yeah, so this is the trip that'll do it.
Yeah, exactly. I'll fix her somehow. yeah, the misadventures of the Jewlanders. What do you do? Oh, well, anything else of note happen we want to chat about? Or you guys ready?
Rob, are you making any snakes?
Not right now. Maybe later in the year. Oh. All my stuff is sort of spring breeder style with rhino rats, probably Puerto Rican boas, assuming that the, you know, not a pressure on it, but assuming the female. I have one female that every other year, she's just like, this is what's happening. And so obviously have to respect and abide. So
abide.
That's cool. Phenomenal. And those are gift only, right? You can't sell those. So
absolutely.
That's a cool project. Yeah.
Yeah.
I like that kind of stuff. I need to read about those things. I got that book and I haven't really cracked it open yet. I've looked through it, but I haven't.
It's pretty heavy. Reading. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It seems like more of a scientific work than a leisurely read. So yeah.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. It's cool.
Cool. How about I'm you, ready Lucas? To throw you some got, haymakers.
You got some Aspidites coming and you got some,
I'm too eager to fight.
Got more garter snakes on the way. And
it's funny. The garter snake thing has become a running joke, but they're actually almost gone. I do need to make more. So, I think she's working on it. I'm expecting two clutches of womas, a possible third. I didn't think that the third girl was going to go, but she is upside down now and, looks to be proving me wrong. outside of that, hoping for blackheads. One of the female is looking very promising. It's off nice. Food and I can feel egg shaped things in there. So that's a good sign. Maybe unfortunately
do the swap.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I was going to say, unfortunately that one is with the male that Nick sent me. So if it all works out and I don't kill them, then I have to send something to that guy. Yeah. And then hopefully Brettles, but like Rob said, you know, talk to me in 4 months or whatever. Yeah. That's about it.
I still have a few, Brettles left over from a couple seasons ago. So I'm not breeding more until I get rid of those.
Totally.
They're such cool snakes. And you know, it's my lack of putting up ads, I'm sure, because yeah, they're pretty stellar looking.
I look at your website. It's like the definition of insanity. I check about once every 2 weeks and it's last updated 2022. Damn it. Like,
actually, I just updated it last week, but I didn't update it
the wrong available website?
Or anything. No, I just put up a visit page from our Utah Herp Trip. So you can see pictures of our Utah Herp Trip. And
well, that's nice. Kind of cool. I'll do that too.
Yeah.
I stand corrected.
I think I put up our, I don't know if I've made it live yet, but I put up our Arizona trip with the Twin Spots too. So,
okay.
The 2023.
Well, that's very cool, Arizona. But I just see a list of WOMAs that I can't buy from 2022 that say outstanding, perfect example.
Yeah. They were very, very nice.
I know that I'm sad. Make more.
Well, you have some very nice bloodlines. I'm sure I could manage a swap with you at some point.
So. Now we're talking.
Yeah,
let's do it.
Sure.
Yeah. Oh, I did pair the wheat belts you sent me since they're kind of cool. Mm-hmm. Like, why not? Right. But I don't think that's going to happen.
Yeah.
I'm just glad they're not killing each other.
Oh yeah. They're pretty good together. Like they, I mean, they like their food, but they're fairly good when you get them out. And then breeding, I haven't ever had any issues except the very first pair that I got out of Europe, the female killed the male.
Right. Yeah.
And yeah, that was kind of crappy, but what do you do?
Good to know. I guess I'll cohab them all.
Yeah. Hey, yeah. Are you trying to... yeah. Well, actually let's have you kind of tell us where you fit into herpetoculture and maybe, okay. I mean, introduce yourself a little bit, but I'm sure probably everybody knows Lucas from NPR fame, but
whatever you've heard is not true, especially if Owen McIntyre said it. But
hear it from
yes,
the horse's mouth.
My name is Lucas. I live in Oakland and I keep and attempt to breed a pretty diverse but somewhat consistent collection of Australian pythons, various colubrids. I'm back in the dwarf monitor game after departing briefly.
Just the Tristis or something else?
Tristis, and I got Ackies again too. Ackies, and Eric might send me his Kim.
Yeah.
So I just I'm
got
in trouble.
Out of Ackies. I sold off the rest of mine. They just weren't.
I missed them. I really missed them. They didn't make sense to keep from like a, you know, if you're thinking of like a business perspective, but from like a loving the animal perspective, I really missed them. Yeah. So that's why I got them back.
Getting some sort of dwarf monitor. I'll probably get Gill and I just because they're smaller. I can keep
that would
them,
be cool.
Agernia. Yeah. They're so
Gill and I
personable.
Are really cool as well.
Yeah.
I'm totally I'm Glowered Eye, but Gill and I I haven't kept a couple of them. Those really cool animals as well.
Yeah.
If I had the opportunity, I'd also do it.
Yeah. They're a little larger, the Glowered Eye. So.
Well, just that tail, man. Otherwise, maybe body length.
Their bodies are pretty
probably
good size.
Pretty
for
similar. Gill and I tend to be heavier, though. I think you know that because Glowered Eye, man, they're race cars. They're just these super long, thin.
That's true.
The Gill and I were more heft to them, and maybe about the same snout to vent on old ones. Yeah. Mm.
Okay.
But it's just the tail, you know, those Glowered Eye tails, obviously.
Big tail.
What, they're two and a half times that body length, and they're cool.
Yeah.
Unless you don't keep them
you should
very,
get Eric to send
you
his. That, there you go, Lucas. The answer is you should have Eric send you his.
I think that's what's happening. it was supposed to be in a box from Owen, but he couldn't get off work. Classic Eric stuff.
Sounds about right.
But let's see.
That's cool.
Should I keep going? Is that enough?
Well,
do you want to know more about me?
I know you from, I served on your committee. So
this is true. This is true.
Masters. And
So I did get my master's in zoo science, with Dr. Loafman, through West Liberty University. So the evidence-based herpetoculture lab there, which was a great time. Prior to that, I kind of cut my teeth working at East Bay Vivarium, getting hands on with a whole bunch of stuff without needing to bring it home, which is wonderful. I've been keeping since about 2018 now. So not that long, but in the course of my life.
You're involved in Carpets and Coffee. And
this is true, yes.
You just co-hosted with Eric on that show where Owen couldn't make it or something with the
At
green
some
trees
point, Eric
David Brahms.
Like made himself available to me and I grabbed on and just he hasn't been able to shake me since. So yeah, you'll hear me on various podcasts. And as you said, Carpets and Coffee every other Monday.
Good times.
And I work as a biologist, but
cool. What do you do?
I work in environmental consulting. So a lot of my field work revolves around, Alameda whip snake, San Francisco garter, giant garter snake, red-legged frog, tiger salamander. We've got a bunch of listed herps out here that there's a lot of red tape for people trying to build things, and that's where we come in.
So. That's good. Somebody's got to stop them from paving over all the habitat. Have you seen San Francisco garters in the wild then?
I have not, but a lot of my coworkers have. I just haven't been at the right place at the right time.
Okay. That and would hopefully be a cool trip.
In a couple weeks. That'd be,
that's right.
Yeah, we're...
You're going to go.
Yeah, we're going for it.
All right. Good luck. That's cool. Yeah, that's another one that's on the bucket list someday. I'd love to see. Yeah. Looks like
absolutely.
You're not allowed to interact with them at all. So you just kind of see them from a distance and take some pictures. Hope you have
absolutely.
A good zoom
but
lens.
Hopefully we can get a couple photos that'll make you anxious to give it a go.
Yeah. Yeah. Good luck, you guys. Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you. I'm sure we'll report back.
Yeah. And it's not too hard of a trip for me, you know, living in northern Utah. It's just kind of straight across almost.
I'll put you up anytime.
Yeah.
There you can go. Sleep in the snake room.
Right on. I've done that a few times. Yeah. Cool. Yeah. Well, glad to have you on finally. I feel bad we haven't had you on earlier, but this is good timing. This will be good.
Okay. So. A lot of, pent up Fight Club rage. I'm ready to throw down. <right.
laughs> Now, you've also got the lost episodes that I'd really like to hear, but you're a co-host.
With Nick?
Yeah. Like, come
I'd like to hear them too.
Well, they're recorded somewhere, right? Does Eric have access to those or are they?
Great question.
Nick's
I don't know.
They sell them on the Patreon or something. Like,
I think that they live. I have some, but then there were a bunch of other ones that I want to listen back to more that I believe live on the video editor's computer because Nick wanted to do a video thing. But anyway, I don't know.
And now Scott and Ty are coming for that corner. Hey.
Are they doing a video thing?
No, in terms of the video, but in terms of
making a podcast. Yeah.
You snooze, you lose, Nick.
Oh, no, don't taunt him.
He doesn't listen to this.
He's going
to
blame me anyway.
He listens to no podcast.
I made that assumption, and then he called me out on something I said on Carpets and Coffee, and now really? I just tiptoe.
I've heard you say a few things on Carpet and Coffee.
You're gentle, right, I don't Nick. Tiptoe at all, but it's okay. I'd say it to his face, too.
Yeah, he needs it.
I love that guy, but yeah.
Well, the only way you could prove us wrong would be to release that content.
There you go.
I'll have to find this gentleman and steal his hard drive.
Exactly.
Video guy.
Perfect. Yeah.
No, there was a really good talk with Dale DiNardo.
The video guy is not the same dude who did the same thing with the previous podcast and B, a certain magazine. Is that all that same person?
It might be, but I don't know. I didn't say anything.
Yeah, right. I mean, like, at some point. Okay, whatever.
Yeah. Yeah.
Whatever.
Lucas shall fool remain neutral.
Fool me twice. You're going to fool me again. All right.
Yeah. For a tenth time.
Fool me six times, you're in trouble. Fool me seven times, I'm coming after you. All right. Well, tonight we're going to talk about cohabbing and the pros and cons of said cohabbing and maybe some experiences we've had or to one side or the other. So, and should be a fun topic for sure. Any particular aspect of cohabbing that we want to hit on or just kind of in general? I think we just go
I
for it.
I think we tackle it from all angles.
Yeah, 100%. I think this had kind of come to my awareness, right? Because I'm mostly off the social media stuff because Keith had sent a message expressing his frustration about a topic pertaining to leopard geckos, which seemed very bizarre to me. You know, in a group chat, I was like, what could be the genesis for this, right? Mm-hmm. And it turns out it was associated with someone putting out content where I guess a creator, I think again, and I could be misunderstanding it because I missed the first wave. I was just trying to pick up the pieces. The guy who does the Wiccan Reptiles, right, had put out a video or something saying he's doing a build, and he was going to put in a male and five female leopard geckos in this cage. And apparently, I don't even know all the inner dynamics that are at play here, but the ultimately that was deemed to be problematic in some way. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
And that's sort of, you know, the either every side, either side of that is basically what brought this to the fore of saying, okay, we can talk through it. Cause I do think there are strong positives and negatives. Frankly, I'd be happy to either argue a single side or be the moderator on this one, because I think there are persuasive points to both. And a lot of it reflects the different species and the experience of the person doing it, not to mention the enclosure, all these different things, right? There's a ton of variables that go into it like anything. But yeah, that's kind of how we came to be here. Let's be relatively timely. And I do think there are good points to either side.
Yeah, I agree. All right, well, go ahead and call it, Rob, and we'll see who gets to fight Lucas.
Heads.
It is tails. Another. Ah. Well, you won last time, so.
I did win last time, right?
Who knows?
Right,
so who do I fight? Maybe I'll take you both. 50-50. You two can team up. That's fine. I'm not scared.
Man, look at the cockiness on this one.
I'm just glad Chuck's not here.
Yeah, well, I don't know. I think where you've been kind of kicking things around and thinking about it, maybe I'll let you go and I'll moderate this one, Rob. And then.
Oh, good.
And then for which side, yeah, I mean, I'm sure I'll kick in there with something or other, because I do enjoy cohabbing. But all right. And then Lucas, you want to call it?
Tails.
Oh, please. Tails. It is tails.
Uh-huh.
So you get the
it's always tails
you want.
Is it?
Yeah, I guess it was twice today.
Shit, now I have to make a decision. I will argue against it, even though I absolutely do it. But that sounds more fun today.
All right. Okay, well, as the winner of the coin toss, you get to decide who goes first. You're going to chuck him, huh? All right. Rob?
In honor of Mr. Poland.
Well, fabulous. Well, I would say one of the principal advantages of keeping animals together, like we can even go to the example that was set here, right, is you're allowing them to fulfill their natural behaviors by giving them access to one another, perhaps unnaturally, point to Lucas. But you're giving them sort of perpetual access. I know, Dr. J, you're well on record of liking to keep pairs of animals together, assuming that they do well in that environment, right? That you're not doing it if they're consistently combating for food, or if you're not providing enough options for them to get access to their fundamentals, right? Heat, food, water, all these different things, maybe conditions where they could shed properly, all this different stuff. If those things are met, then you don't even notice them breeding, because they're attuned to one another. It's not an artificial stimuli of you placing them together when you think it's the right time. And often you just either arrive to find a beautiful pile of eggs, or arrive a week after you've been away to find a pile of eggs that didn't look quite as good as it did a week before. So I think it does allow them to effectuate their natural behavior. And yeah, it's really cool as well.
Well, in some cases, though, that natural behavior might be ones that you do not want to allow to be effectuated. Is that the big word you used? Sorry, I missed it. For instance, I just had two rhinos almost kill each other because of their natural inclinations. And if I had not been cohabbing them, no blood would have been shed. In addition, your point about big asterisk. Yes, cohabbing is absolutely fine. Big asterisk. If everybody can have their food, heat, water, shelter, blah, blah, blah needs met in this utopian enclosure in which that is the case, I think that in the vast majority of reptile rooms, that is probably not the case with what people are working with. And I would point to an example that I had a pair of Aki monitors in a very large enclosure, and you know, this had multiple basking sites, multiple hides, multiple water sources, everything, you know, threefold for the animals that they could want. And yet still the dominant male kept the female, essentially he would bully her into the nest box and wouldn't let her leave. And she almost passed. I had to spend a lot of money at the vet because she was dehydrated. She wasn't eating. There was a whole bunch of problems associated with that. So while I do agree that there are instances where this can work, I don't necessarily know that there is ever a benefit to anybody but the keeper. I know it's economical for us. I know that we can see interactions that we might perceive as, oh, they're cute, they're cuddling, they're laying together, they are choosing to be with each other. But is that really of benefit to the animal, where in the wild they could get away from each other whenever they wanted, whenever they felt they were done, and then they can't do that in these boxes? I guess I should also say I'm definitely thinking about this mostly from like a snake and lizard perspective. I'm sure that there's other things that do better together, but yeah.
No, wait, let me get this straight. You kept a pair of male rhino rats together?
Right.
Well, I'm glad you asked.
What I was going to say is, hey, you did get to find something out, and that was that your, quote, pair of rhino rat snakes were actually two males. You found something
Thanks,
out.
Thanks, Dr. Loafman.
A path of discovery.
Yeah, you wouldn't have learned that otherwise.
You wouldn't have known.
If they wouldn't
I tried to breed them. But yes, yeah. Point taken.
Yeah.
I see what you mean.
Right. Yeah, I was thinking at that same point. The other thing that I would say, right, is it does where I thought you were going, and actually, so the where you actually went then makes sense to me as well. But I assumed what you were going to say is even with an abundance of choice, right, within an enclosure, what you were finding is there does seem to be sort of a best basking spot or a best access to water or best, quote, best, right, or a preferential, mm-hmm. best reflecting seeming preference, right? Even if there are multiple, they're not necessarily, we might perceive them to be equitable, but it doesn't mean necessarily that the animals themselves will perceive them that way. So that's sort of where I expected you were going. The notion of then just sort of being shunted to the side or trapped in an area where they couldn't access any of the multiple spots and things. Yeah, I've seen that too. You know, I've seen that. I saw that with a trio then of Glauridae that were together. It was two females that were together for a long time without issue, added a male. And this is going back to the sort of that lull period when the Glauridae availability in the States probably went into either low double or single digits. And before they started being, you know, coming back in with those cleared paperwork and all that stuff. But yeah, I've definitely seen it. I've definitely seen it. I had what turned out to be six male Pilbarensis, or, you know, Hemerzlionsis pilbarensis, the U.S., right? Yeah. U.S. Pilbarensis, which could be, you know, a one or both or a mix,
right? Yeah.
Right. You know, yeah. Where that caused its own set of problems. So I certainly can appreciate where you're going with that. You know, I do think that's something. And I do think in terms of monitors, right, we see stuff that we know of and scientifically, right, in terms of fish. And I think varanids have shown that they do the same thing, where if you go back to, you know, love Robin and Chad, but if you were to go back in on the Wayback Machine, let's say, you'll see content that says, hey, whenever we raise up three Acanthuras together, it magically looks like 1.2. 95% of the time, it magically looks like 1.2, meaning that it's 1.2 being the natural implication there. And I know that that's not right. And I think the phenomenon that we're seeing is sort of the sneaker male situation, where you have these males that appear to be females, whether they then will breed as males or not, you know, sort of, but it certainly speaks to groups of monitors from the late 90s through the, you know, through to 2010 or whatever, where people are taking that mindset and saying, hey, I'm just going to, these monitors, you have to raise them as hatchlings together, and then you magically always wind up with these groups that look like a dominant male, and the rest appear to be female. But some of those never produce eggs. And the answer, to my mind at least, is that those that look like females doesn't mean that they're actually females. It just means they haven't developed the secondary characteristics that we associate with the male form. And so those groups where it's, oh, it's 1 point, they look like 1.2. I mean, you know, you got one that is obviously a male, and then you have two that look like females. But in reality, I've seen it where it's three males. So that's obviously a social impact, right? The social lives of reptiles, right? That's at play there. So you are effectuating that behavior. And Lucas, I don't think, you know, it's wrong to say that there's certainly an ethical question, if not problem, with it. Forcing that development, right? So yeah, I think that's totally fair. At the same time, hey, you mentioned that cute and cuddly picture, and yeah, they are cute and cuddly. I'm glad you admitted that. So all good. If you can say some more. I've just said a bunch. I don't know how responsive I was.
I'll also just say, you know, in terms of, it seemed to me in your opening point that the biggest plus in the column for cohabbing is kind of exposing behaviors that we can observe that are unique to that situation. Is that fair to say? Does that feel like an oversimplification of your point?
I don't know. My point might just be that it's cool and they're beautiful and you're allowing them to effectuate their, you know.
That is the word, effectuate. Yes. Effectuate their natural behaviors. But I would say, again, that is purely for the benefit of the observer in many cases. That doesn't necessarily mean that the behaviors in question are of benefit to the animal. In fact, maybe they are a product of stress, of you know, negative states of being that we might just perceive as something neat to observe. How does it benefit the animal?
I'm having flashbacks to my thesis. Especially where Lucas has challenged us both and got so cocky with it. No. But I would probably bring up in regards to lizards, like lizards tend to be much, and I think snakes to a certain degree are also social in some ways. You know, we don't know a ton about it, but I think keeping lizards by themselves sometimes is almost like, you know, putting something in solitary confinement. If they don't have that group structure, I mean, in nature, you go and you find a side blotch lizard male, and there's two or three females around his rock, and he's fighting with another male on this other rock, you know, so he's got his little territory. And, you know, so I think lizard lives especially almost require some sort of cohabitation to keep them with
that
know,
engagement
properly
is
so
their
they don't
fundamental
go crazy.
You know,
I will concede that in the cases of lizards with a definite objective social structure and sociality that is just, that's just a fact. I will concede that obviously you should keep them that way. Same for potentially like a colony of garter snakes or something like that. I think that we can all agree that if it is part of their natural history to live in a family unit or to congregate, then that's different. So I would, can we perhaps agree on that point and proceed in this debate with everything else?
I think, but I mean, there is some complexity. I'll give an example. I wanted to bring this one up, but my friend had a group of tree skinks, Sigurnia striolata, and they had babies, right? And so there were five or six babies, and pretty, and everybody was harmonious, but they were kind of overrunning the capacity of the cage, and more babies were coming or whatever. So he separated out the babies, and once he took those babies and put them in another cage. All of a sudden, all hell broke loose, and three of them, you know, got beat up to the point where they couldn't even be saved. And like, so, I mean, it was a bloodbath. And so you had a defined structure with the parents, but then as soon as you take them out, they're fighting for position or whatever. So, I mean, you do have to understand you know, kind of the social structure. And maybe in a lot of cases, we don't understand that and we don't know. But, you know, I don't know that I would have thought that much. Like, I would have thought, oh, you just put them in a separate enclosure and everything will be fine. But we do know, you know, if there's multiple males in there, that can be problematic. And until we get, you know, Ben develops his sexing for skin sheds of skinks, we're kind of stuck, you know, working things out and just paying attention. I don't think anybody's suggesting cohabitation as a set it and forget it. You know, you do have to keep an eye on things.
Right.
And make sure that you're intervening when it doesn't work out.
The two things that jump out to me are kind of the point you raised there, Dr. J, in terms of, I do think it requires more engagement from the it requires more engagement from the keeper to keep things together. And the second thing, right, would be, I think it is recognized either between recognizing / acknowledging or imagining, depending on your point of view, sort of the complexity of these creatures, as opposed to saying, no, they want to be safe and totally alone, desolate in a 6-quart Rubbermaid box, right? Those are two different approaches. And I wonder, right, coming – all of us, you know, particularly Lucas, are coming out of a time frame that's all about sort of the sterile keeping, right? That's the one perspective where at least Justin and I have some more of sort of the Philippe school of, you know, creating environments where the stuff can engage with one another. That I think just in here in the conversation, right, I can't help but feel that part of the language that speaks to they do best by themselves, isolated in little tiny boxes, comes from sort of the commercialism associated with mass
freedom. Who said little tiny boxes? I don't think anybody said that.
Well,
right?
I mean,
or it could be a slightly larger box. In either case, to the point that you made, right, and I do think there's a ton of fairness to it of saying, like, sure, if they're in a football field size environment, right, there are places that for animals to remove themselves from one another with safety that, regardless of the size of the cage, almost certainly that's going to be space limited so that we can't provide an equivalent situation. I totally acknowledge that. I think that's totally fair that there's the capacity to get away unconstrained by a cage will exceed that is constrained by a cage. Absolutely. But I just kind of wonder if a lot of the language around, hey, everything needs to be kept individually is related with keeping a lot of things and, you know, kind of the preference for sort of the big breeder style mentality that we touched on last week.
But I feel that there's an inherent contradiction in that point, in that by definition, you can have more animals and fit more animals into the same space if you're cohabbing. So wouldn't cohabbing be more favorable if your goal was to be big box store and have as much going on as possible?
It depends. So I think it depends, right? So if you're talking about putting adult cow kings in a 6-quart tub, that's probably, you know, I mean, there's only so much you can fit into that space if that's our size definition. But yeah, so it all depends on the enclosure that you're putting them in with. And are you acknowledging that, hey, the potential that things could go poorly? So that probably means that you have to have an empty tub for every tub that has a pair of snakes. You also need to have an empty tub to be able to pull them apart should there be an issue, or to feed them. You know, some things you can feed together when you keep them together. Other things, you're asking for trouble. And it certainly means that you got to stand there and wait till they fully eat it, or you might end up with one instead of two. So, I mean, done properly, no, it won't save you any space because each one will have to have their own separate space that you could put them in, right? You're not.
I mean,
totally bound
if you're responsible,
you to,
then
you
that's the case.
Well.
But are we saying that everybody's responsible?
Well, that'd be the position that I would advocate. You know, whether people do that or not, people do all sorts of crazy stuff.
I think inherently my snake bias is showing, right? And so I'll again say that I've never kept lizards without cohabbing, and there's probably a better case for many species of lizard. However, I do think when, you know, of course you just brought up the point of needing to feed animals in a cohab situation and how much can go wrong there, how much extra work that creates, how much extra handling in many cases when animals need to be separated, which is, you know, for some critters rather stressful. We just heard Dr. Gavin Bedford say that messing with an own pelly once made it not eat for another 4 months. Yeah. you know, these aren't trivial things.
I would clarify that he was talking about a 4-hour interaction that was supposed to be, what, 15, 20 minutes. So I don't know that.
Objection, hearsay.
He did highlight that he perceives the animals to perceive him, right? And so that there's a difference between how yes. he
and I believe
the
it
response
too.
To him
I've heard
and
that
other
from
people. Yeah,
many people.
I think there's something to that. I'm not discounting it by framing it in that way. I'm just trying to be clear on that.
Let the record show.
I don't think that's exactly the situation that he was describing. I think he could probably separate.
Certainly not.
I
invoked this example simply to highlight how devastating a spike in these stress hormones can be for these animals. And if we're talking about needing to handle some high stress animal every time we need to feed it because of a cohab situation, well, that could be pretty deleterious.
That's species by species, right? And certainly
everything is species by species.
Well, maybe the point that I would just want to highlight, you know, and I respect what you're saying there, is just that, like, to me, and I don't know that I framed this really well before, right, in terms of the commercial aspect and whatever, that in that framework, I guess in my mind, what I'm imagining is someone needs to make the interactions they have with a given ecosystem, right, the given cage, as quick as possible. If you're going to cohab animals, right, you're going to have to double the time, at least double the time that you're interacting to perform that feeding, because you can totally successfully manage it. But I say double because they're the two animals together, but in reality, it's probably tripling, quadrupling, whatever, the amount of time, because you have to fully see the process through. This is not throwing in a defrosted mouse and seeing what happens. This is waiting for them to fully consume each item. And if you're feeding multiple items in one go, I mean, literally, we could be talking about 10, 15, 20 minutes. A pair of rhino rats in an enclosure. Hey, you got to have four that are thawed out, ready to go, and you're just feeding. And then if they get to the last one and the last one still isn't fully done, then you pull it out and whatever. So all that stuff, that's going to take, I don't know, between 5 and 10 times longer than it would if you kept them separately and just tossed in something and closed the tub.
Yes, indeed. No doubt, makes the keeper's life harder, and it raises the level of risk for the animals involved inherently to injure one another, perhaps themselves.
It does demand a greater degree of competency from the keeper.
It does indeed.
Happy to concede that point. Happy
and
to.
Will you also you concede?
Said it, made it easy. It was for the ease of the keeper, Lucas, but it's the
opposite. I said it's.
That, yeah.
I didn't say for the.
Some people
me.
Do that. That
excuse
way.
Me. Yeah. I meant it's for ease of shoving as many animals into a small space as possible.
Nobody's arguing that works, you know, like that. Yeah, I agree. And I do think that to Lucas's point, a lot of these things like, you know, cohabbing and buying, like we talked about with the monitor world where they said, oh, if you buy, you know, three animals, you'll probably get a pair. And if you buy five animals, you're guaranteed to get a trio.
Absolutely.
Or whatever, you know.
Couldn't
and
be
so,
anything else.
You know, this the salesman technique of, you know, and then you wind up with five male pilbarensis and oh wait,
and I don't think
happen.
It was even intent with maybe one exception. I don't think it was intended to be deceitful, right? They genuinely look like you have a male
it.
And four female, you know, like that. I don't and then it's just confusing why it doesn't produce anything, or it produces less than it seems like it should, right? It'll be like I only get one clutch of eggs out of this, you know.
And I think
1.4 groups.
Wait,
that all kind of came from, you know, Frank Redius, and you know, after years and years of this, I heard him tell people it works best in pairs. You can do trios, but it works best as pairs. And I think, you know, that kind of went against what we heard in the early 90s.
And probably pairs that are raised to where they're showing their secondary sexual characteristics, you know, separately, and then finding a pair that will go together, you know, that will accept being in the presence of one another. That's really probably the ideal way to pair monitors at this point.
I
think even Frank came to that.
Hold on.
Yeah.
Rewind. Record scratch. It makes things harder for the keeper, and it increases the inherent risk for the animals.
Not
necessarily. You use that as a point against me. as
I'm just talking,
saying,
man. There's no, you know, points.
Oh, is it not really a fight anymore?
Well, I'm just talking.
Sorry, I thought we were fighting.
Negative. I'm just in the realm of reality. Like, that's all.
Well, then, okay. Well, then I need to change my whole persona because I do have.
It's an oversimplification to say that it results in damage to the animals. I didn't say damage in all cases.
I said it negative. Increases risk.
Oh, yeah.
To feed cohabbed animals.
Yeah.
No, absolutely. Well, I mean, theoretically.
So what's the pro?
The ones that will advantage.
I hear a lot of cons.
Like, they'll eat their own tails. Like, we've all been there.
I mean, I've been wanting to cite this for a little bit here. There's a cohab exhibit at the California Academy of Sciences, an AZA accredited institution in San Francisco, where there are, I believe, four Pretels pythons and four Woma pythons in a cylindrical tall enclosure where the Womas are mostly terrestrial on the floor in the rocks and the Pretels have branches to get out of there. Now, I have a coworker who is a biologist at said institution, and I know for a fact that after every time they feed those animals, they now have a protocol where they have to wash every single one because the Womas will try to eat anything that moves when they put them back in there because everything smells like rodent. How is that of benefit to anybody except the third graders on their field trip that see a lot of snakes?
Coming to appreciate the beauty of reptiles. I mean, coming to become fascinated with Australia. Yeah. Expanding their minds? What? That's nothing?
No, that's not nothing. However, are we arguing that cohabbing is good for educating the public or whether it's a good practice for herpetoculture?
Well, it probably is actually good for educating the public, right? Because the biggest question when folks go to a zoo or aquarium is, can they see the animal within, what, 5 or 10 seconds? And if the answer is no, then they wind up moving on. So that's not making much of an impact if you have one animal in there that's hidden away. So, yeah, probably cohabbing does influence the capacity of a given enclosure to influence someone's life.
And citing AZA, they have a lot of crazy rules. Like, I mean, that could make no difference at all. You know, if you wash the snakes. Now, you know, obviously they have to do certain things or else they're not AZA accredited. They have to.
Also, I don't know if I was supposed to talk about that. So all the listeners are pinky promised to secrecy about that.
Yeah. I was going to say, you know, we
sounds like a good practice. So
there was a confiscation of some lizards. And they went to a major zoo, and we went and saw them at this major zoo, and they had them all in the same cage, even though, I mean, technically they were all the same species. They were all Egernia depressa at the time, and this was before the big split. But the person who brought them out of Australia knew that they were different and kept, you know, had different trade names for these different types. But the zoo, they're all Egernia depressa. So they put them all in one cage, and when we went and saw them, There was Depressa in one corner and Signitos in another corner and, you know, Epsisolus in another corner. They were all separate and you could see kind of battle scars and things. And we said, now, why are you keeping these all in the same cage? They're obviously different. They're obviously choosing separate sides of the enclosure. Why aren't you separating them? You know, it looks like they've got some damage. Oh, they're fine. No big deal. Like, and this is one of the biggest zoos in the world. You know, it's like, come on, guys, really?
So is your point that
the point is if the keeper is not in tune, yes, it can be a negative thing. But if it's somebody like myself and notices these things and says, okay, it's time to separate these groups into the groups that they're preferring, you know, like this one's antisocial. I'm going to take this one out and see how the interaction goes from there. You know, if you're keep paying attention,
it does demand that responsivity.
Yeah,
absolutely.
So
that does take more time, but at the same time, the animals that have that social structure in nature, like Egernia depressa, they want to be in a group.
Fit under my asterisk from earlier of, you know, no contest. But what it sounds like, what I'm hearing here in the Fight Club octagon.
Is it a squamata? Then it's in the exception. Okay, fair enough.
No! What I'm hearing is a consensus from both of you that what I have been saying is correct, which is that cohabbing is pretty much only for the benefit.
No. I think Rob brought that
observation.
Up. I mean, my favorite part of cohabbing that Rob brought up was that they know each other's cycles. So you don't have to introduce them every week and make sure that they're, you know, that you witness a copulation or whatever. You're they're together. They know each other's cycles. They don't have to breed. You know, you're not tiring out your male with endless breeding introductions and strategies because they know their cycle. They know when the female's receptive. So they breed at that time and no other time. It's not for recreation. It's for procreation. So they get the job done. You hardly ever see it. And then you see eggs and it works out like a dream. And when the female's obviously gravid, I'll take the male out so he doesn't cause any undue stress and things work great.
Because you have a separate cage for him because you're not utilizing this as an opportunity.
Okay, so it's not
more
cohabbing
in the same box, right? And you know,
it's not cohabbing per se. It's extensive pairing.
But no, I'll sometimes leave him in there. The female lay, and it's not a big deal,
right? Or if it's an off season, like occasionally, yeah. I'm sure you had seasons where they didn't produce anything, yeah. despite being yeah. you know paired together that whole time. Honestly, I thought
and there's also cases. Where they'll get bred to death because they're always together.
Well,
yeah, maybe. I mean, that's
we
can, possibility.
Hold on, let me put a pin in that one. We'll put a pin
I'm just trying to fight, guys. I don't know. Yeah.
No, I've never seen that with snakes. Like, you know what
oh,
I mean?
False
like,
water cobras. Absolutely.
Well, I don't keep those crazy things.
That means they don't exist
that's
then.
The term, they don't exist.
Exactly.
The part I was going to say, what I assumed the grievance with the Wiccans build would be that you're going to just produce all these leopard geckos, right? Inherently, if you're putting together this with that structure with a male and these five females, I would have assumed that it was actually the push would be against, hey, you're just going to make all these leopard geckos and they're all going to be half siblings and all this stuff. If you
that would be how I
and you
think
probably
as well.
Won't keep track of it.
But I don't think that's what people were mad about. I think if I'm interpreting it correctly, I think that the beef was more about the just concept of keeping leopard geckos together at all and
not
the amount of animals
in
the space.
Yeah, not just singly, right?
Right.
Yeah. No, yeah. I think I take it that same way, but that was surprise. You know, again, coming to this late and then with sort of a different perspective, I was just sort of befuddled about that because I would have assumed I do think there's something to be said for that, right? Maybe one of the biggest cons associated with cohabitation, at least to the extent that you are talking about, you know, a mixed gender pair, would be the possibility of reproduction, meaning animals that you don't necessarily have a home or a market for. And that's sort of where I thought that would go, right? Is why can't it just be those five females together? You know, that sort of natural implication with that mixed gender situation that you were going to produce more offspring. That's what I assumed it would be. And then it wasn't, which I found pretty weird.
Right. I see what you're saying. Yeah. They would have still burned him at the stake.
Right. Which is super strange. And I mean, pretty I guess an aspect of this to consider, right, is sort of what are the implications of the educational materials, whatever form that might take, of the stuff of the content that has been put out there over time that has brought us to from the universe where leopard gecko breeding in captivity literally went from people are overstating it a little bit. I think it was, you know, cattle stock Ron Tremper cattle stock troughs with 5 males and 100 females or whatever. Right. So that actually is a situation where within that, maybe there was such density, as we talked about earlier, that you could actually put together multiple male leopard geckos without an issue. But that's the universe that we've come from. And now the notion that you would keep two together is,
right.
You know, beyond the pale yeah. is really something and suggests maybe we need to critically evaluate the content that we're putting out and whether you know, kind of where we're at. It raises all sorts.
Well, nobody would fight that. And I'll go ahead and I'll drop the devil's advocate fighting persona and we can just chat now. But basically what I would say is I think when people are writing these internet care sheets or filming their how to take care of this species videos for YouTube, I think that the cop out is to just always say cohabitating not recommended, and then you're free of any liability as a author or creator for anything that might go wrong. That doesn't mean in any case that it can't be done or that it shouldn't be done. I just think it has become a universal way of washing hands of any potential problem that somebody could come back and say, look what you've done. My beloved Jeffrey is dead. So I, and like you're saying, a generation of keepers entering the hobby, digesting that information as their proprietary source of knowledge, would lead to a general populace that would point at cohabbing leopard geckos as, satanic practice.
I didn't know you could keep them individually. I thought they were always cohabitated. Maybe yes. That's being brought up in the box store mentality of, you know, keeping reptiles and just
keeping producing to produce them everything and all that. Yeah.
And I mean, that was the common practice, right? To have a tub with one male and five females.
One male and four, three to five females. And all go in there.
Same with African fat tails. Yeah. I would have people when I was working at the vivarium come try to fight the employees a few times a week about multiple leopard geckos being for sale in the same enclosure, bearded dragons, et cetera, et cetera. So. Again, I now dropping the persona, I feel that the correct and nuanced way to discuss this is that, like you've been saying, there are situations where it totally works and you might just have to be a little bit more on top of your, you know what, as a keeper. There are situations where it totally works and you really don't need to be. I keep entire litters of garter snakes together. I feed them together. Nothing bad happens. It's fine. It is completely species dependent and environment dependent, animal dependent, you dependent. How much time are you available to watch and make sure things are actually going well? Do you have the time to separate the animals and see this feeding process through, like Rob was describing earlier? So,
and there can be like times all these where that's fights, not true, you know? Right? We're not. Yeah, to your point, right? That's not always, you know, where I do think it demands a greater level of availability, skill, and care that's being put into it. And we're not all universally available, you know, to meet those needs, right? And so sometimes it could be great, and other times if you're away on tour, away on a trip, you know, that's what we're – whatever. Like, then we're taking a greater risk than someone who's keeping them separately, right? You know, you're unlikely to have an animal alone by itself in a cage – eat a cage mate, then not impossible, right? People have seen that where things will get out and go into another cage and eat it or whatever. They were intended to be kept singly, and then you wind up with one. So there you go. Sure. And yeah.
In practice as a keeper, I've had both wonderful and horrendous things happen as a result of my cohabbing animals. In most cases, the horrendous things could have been prevented by me being a better keeper. And you know, that's the risk you take.
I think we could also say that for the opposite. You know, I've kept things singly and I've had horrendous things happen, you know, when I keep things by themselves too. So it's, you know,
of course, there's
no guarantee that keeping them separate is going to prevent any bad thing from happening. You
know? I agree what you're saying. And that's not necessarily what I was implying either. I meant more specifically at the hands of the other. Sure. But, you know, and to your point about breeding, Justin, there's no doubt that it is advantageous for the animals to be familiar with each other. They're not overexcited. They're not, you know, blowing their load, if you will, at the wrong time. sorry. However,
could you be less scientific with your terminology?
No.
I don't think I understand what you're saying.
yes. crap. What was I saying?
Sorry.
That's okay.
Yeah.
Oh, but no, I was just going to say you can also keep solitary and then introduce and then they eat each other. Like they could still kill each other if they're only together for 10 minutes, you know? So yeah, breeding is breeding.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, and sometimes you might be able to argue that that would be a more likelihood if they're unfamiliar with each other, introducing them, then, oh, is this a food item? Is this a mate? You know, I'm going to strike first and ask questions later, you know? And I love to cohab, baby Antaresia, like when they hatch, I'll put them all in one tub and let them, you know, hang out together. And it seems like, I mean, you know, they're all kind of clumped together. And I think in the wild, we see examples of that. You know, you've got the timber rattlesnakes where multiple females will go to a decent spot and have all their litters, and one female will watch litters of others. They've kind of shown that scientifically, that these females are caring or helping to whatever they're doing for other litters. You know, maybe that happens in the wild. We don't know a lot about what's in the wild, but if you leave them together too long, all of a sudden you've got one less and a big fat, you know, baby that probably won't survive either. So,
right.
You know, it's not the best case scenario. So you do have to make sure that you're separating them in time as well. And who knows, maybe in the wild, they'll eat the weak one and that's their first meal and they go about their, you know, business. Who knows if that's the case, because we don't have a lot of information on dispersion and how long these little baby Antaresia or any python kind of stick together with the mom or in the same area as each other. So,
yeah. For what it's worth, I see that with the across multiple litters of both Calabothras that I keep, the Puerto Ricans and Jamaican boas, where when they're, I'll pull them all together and leave them together until they shed. And invariably you come into an entire pile of all of them together within a given tub. And that goes for, it'll stay like that for a week, 2 weeks, something like that, where they're
garter snakes
sort of,
will congregate.
They are aggregating together.
Yeah. The Ackies would do that for me as well. When I had a big bunch of baby Ackies in the, you know, a big, cattle trough, you know, there was no reason for them to do that other than choosing to. So I agree with that as well. And I do think that it is very, very worth doing to observe the behaviors that, like you were mentioning at the beginning.
I do think the point you raised that really is super important, though, is in terms of planning things out, that people would, just for your own sanity and potential functionality of the system, you have to be planning it as though everything could go by itself should things go sideways on you. I do think that's a great point. This isn't a mechanism to save space or have twice as much stuff. Like you should, the plan should be that, okay, when they're paired together, be it for a day or a year, you know, or a year or indefinitely, there should be a separate space where you could pull them apart if you had to.
Yeah, like my rhinos.
Yeah. When you needed to use it basically right away.
What do you think about different species cohabiting? Because, I mean, like you said, the woman and the Brettles in exhibit, I love to see that kind of
stuff. It's an amazing exhibit. Know? Yeah. I just needed to shit on it for the persona, but it's one of my favorite exhibits.
Yeah.
I absolutely personally love cohabbing between different species that share the same environment, you know, truly. I get a bit of the ick if it's, you know, like two species that can exist together, but they're from like two different continents, like just because they can, I don't think we should, but if it's illustrating more of
they're
a complete
from Africa
ecosystem, then right. Exactly.
Well, I mean, so that what that reminds me of, right? So Denver Zoo for a long time has had an enclosure that has chondros and emeralds in together that do well, you know, and that's maybe sort of the sweet spot, right? Of having to the point that you're raising of saying, okay, things that wouldn't otherwise go together. This is, they're entirely making the point, right? In terms of you have this.
Yes. If they have a plaque explaining that they evolved this way completely separately, then I'm happy with it.
But like one exhibit at the Baltimore Aquarium was really cool. It had an Ackie, an Agurnia, a Hosmeri, a Hosmer skink, you know, a spiny tailed skink. It had bearded dragon, a frilled lizard, like, you know, just kind of one of each or a pair of each or whatever. And they have their little corners of the area. There's an exhibit at the Perth Zoo that has, like, it's a very large, expansive enclosure, just like glass walls around it and kind of covering the middle section of their reptile house. And it's got shinglebacks and western blue tongues and frilled lizards and bearded dragons, and they all kind of can do their thing and get away from each other if they need to, you know. So it's really kind of cool. But I imagine there's still, like, I was in Alice Springs, and they had an enclosure kind of similar to that, and they had some shingleback skinks and some, and I hear this horrible noise, and I look over, and these shingleback skinks are like battling to the death. They're like chomping on each other's tails, you know, like chasing each other around. So I'm like, you might want to separate. He's like, oh, thank you. And he ran in and grabbed one and took it out, you know, put it in a different enclosure. So, I mean, you know, you still need to pay attention, even if there's plenty of space for them to get away from each other. Sometimes they'll just harass and pursue, you know, until they kill the other one, you know, if that's their goal. And they'll do that in the wild too. It's not to say that the wild is utopia.
Nature being
where
nature.
Everybody's happy. And yeah, they'll chase each other down and kill each other in the wild too, you know.
Like, how naturalistic do you really want naturalistic?
Yeah. And that stress and those kind of things can sometimes, I mean, there is a level, I think, of good stress. I mean, you talk about stress like, you know, it's only a negative, but I think
I also agree,
you know,
for the record.
Yeah. Yeah. There's like that drive to,
I hate who
to
I
live
was.
And but you know, that, there is some level of good stress, I think, in some of these cases. And, you know, of course that requires us to know these animals, know their natural history, know what they need and what they don't need, you know? So.
Right. I mean, the thing, as you guys were describing both the Baltimore and the Perth Zoo, just the skill and intuitiveness that would be required to make an enclosure that could provide the functionality for all those different things really reflects well on the, you know, the capabilities of the keepers that are making that even possible, right?
Yeah.
You know, in terms of saying how within this box or within this sphere or whatever, can we make a suitable atmosphere for all these, for this diversity of ecosystems and needs? Yeah. That's super impressive.
It was a big emphasis in the Zoo Science Master mixed species exhibits. I had to, you know, write a bunch of papers on that for herp class, mammalogy, a bunch of different, you know, types of animals, because it is such a delicate balance, and it's a thought exercise at the beginning that you're never going to know how it goes until it's put into practice. But, you know, there, you can think endlessly about the different variables there and try to create something that won't end in disaster.
Yeah. Some individuals are just jerks. Like there was a fly river turtle, and it would just chase around all the other turtles and just harass them and nip at them. And so they just had to like either make a way for the turtles to get somewhere where it couldn't follow, or, you know, or just take it out and put it somewhere else for a while, or put it in isolation. You know, that's kind of some animals are just, for whatever reason, just want to see
right,
the world
Stampy.
Burn.
The jokers of the
feisty felines.
I mean, even the Monterey Bay Aquarium was able to pull off cohabbing a great white shark for a while. They couldn't do it indefinitely, but, you know, that's pretty impressive.
I
should say cohabbing with tuna and like everything that would fit. I'm not talking about multiple sharks. I'm talking about prey.
Well, and I think, you know, a lot of times they have those really, I mean, I love those multi-species exhibits, you know, where you have like a bunch of different fish and some, you know, turtles and some frogs or snakes or something, you know, that's pretty cool. Good
I
stuff.
Agree.
So,
and I think that's why cohabbing can be so fun at home is because it definitely makes it more like a zoo in your living room, a piece of nature in your house. You know, I get that. That's why I do it. So,
And how about cohabbing prey species? I've got a mealworm colony that's thriving in my roach colony. So I have two prey species in the same box.
Yeah,
it works out great.
You need to keep your crickets singularly in weekly organized pill containers.
Yeah. Speaking of AZA, they have to do welfare checks on their insect colonies. Like they have to go through
really?
Pick up each roach and make sure it's okay. And like there's different, I mean, they kind of take those things to the extreme because the public demands it. And, you know, they're supported by public funds in a lot of cases. So,
yeah.
Yep.
Now
and we should care as much as that about our reptiles that we keep, you know, there's no disposable animals. So don't just be like, oh, I'll just, right. you know, if this thing eats this, I'll just buy another one. You know, that's not the best attitude to have.
Yes. Yeah. With the illusion of fight broken, are there any species that either of you guys would never cohab?
I mean, I think there are some. Yeah, I mean, definitely there's some reptiles that are solitary and that try to kill each other if they necessarily come into contact too often or something like that. I'm trying to think. It seems like certain chameleons are like that. The Namaqua yeah. chameleons are pretty, they'll cannibalize younger, smaller animals all the time in the wild in captivity too. So, you know, you wouldn't want to keep your Namaqua chameleons together. Unfortunately, we don't have that option here. They're
although maybe doing, soon, it seems like they're really taking off in Europe, which is cool.
They're such a cool species.
Yeah, we touched on that a couple of times. Yeah, mm-hmm. so bad.
Yeah.
I think, right, the natural history, it would be those things like that where the natural history reflects that they stay far apart. But they, sort of the inverse of that is like the Solomon Island tree boas, where those things live on, obviously a great density of them lives on the handful of small islands that they do based on the number that have been exported from the Solomon Islands over time. They must live in incredible concentrations, and that's sort of seconded by the behavior I see from the males towards one another and how they interact with females and all this stuff. Clearly, those are an animal that has a social structure that they need to accommodate, right? The opposite would be like Namaqua, where it's these individual road warriors, right, just going about life, trying to jam anything they can in their mouth and not get eaten by the thing one step bigger. The other thing practically is anything that is so big and fast that it's really unmanageable to try and be feeding them together, right? So that if we're talking about false water cobras, that's probably pretty hectic and you got to be on your game. And there are probably times where even someone who's really on their game might fall short and that could have really serious consequences. Rhino rat snakes, you're totally fine. They're not that fast. It's not that big of a deal.
Or species that require such, great personal distance or personal range that it's not feasible
not
to do that in
to
the
do
same
it.
Enclosure because they need their space, but you know, you can't provide it unless you have a warehouse or something, you know, like that's crocodile true, yeah. monitors or something. It might be very difficult to cohab those
croc monitors. Yeah. I was thinking that too. Yeah. I mean, and I'm sure it's happened to you guys if it's happened to me already. In my young career, I've had instances where I've got stuff paired up that they would never look at each other as food, but it's nighttime and something moves wrong and they just grab each other because something moved out of the corner of their eye. You know, that's happened to me with Brettles like 3 times.
Brettles are some of the worst offenders at that.
Yeah.
you usually have to have them on opposite sides of the cage or in, you know, separate cages or else they're,
they're very reactive.
And I think too, with, you know, pythons and, you know, things that aren't eating on a daily basis, separating to feed is probably not that big of a deal or not that much of a stressor. You know, if you're having to separate them twice a month when you feed them as adults,
agreed.
It's not too big a deal.
In the cases I'm referencing, though, there wasn't even food involved. It's just nighttime and
mine,
something moves wrong.
Smell food in the room and something moves. Yeah. They're grabbing it. Yeah, it can be obnoxious. You're like, come on, guys, knock it off.
Enough of this.
But I have noticed that I rarely see any long-term effects from snakes grabbing each other, even though like sometimes you're like prying them apart and you're like, man, they're going to be messed up, but I really haven't seen that.
Nice.
It's I've never had like a big wound, you know, maybe if you had like a couple males that you didn't know were males and you left them together. I mean, carpets can rip each other to shreds in that case. But I think a prey, you know, going for prey, it's, you know, it is, there is a risk, but, you know, I've seen it happen quite a few times, and I've never, you know, at least knock on wood, I haven't seen any major issues in my collection from that.
I think that's pretty much right. The thing that it reminds me of is that Loxosemus in the Reproductive Husbandry book that is just totally destroyed. It was two males, I believe, were kept together. And it just, talk about a gruesome photo where we're talking about deep beyond sort of imagination lacerations and things. I think maybe it's Dallas or Fort Worth Zoo, something like that, where it inadvertently left two males together, and horrific. Truly horrific. And some of these things, it seems like with rhinos, at least their skin is super resilient to everything but the teeth of their own species. So there's the thing most likely to cause them damage, and it looks like you took like a razor blade to it, you know.
Yeah,
whereas
you see it with Drymarcon a lot.
Yeah, where they're pretty resilient to, say, you have like a mouse will grab it, and the I've actually seen it where the scales will pull away but not be perforated. There's no wound, but a copulatory bite from their own species can slice them open, you know, the almond-shaped wound, like a sort of a razor blade type cut. It's pretty pretty interesting.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, you'll but see I agree that with in you.
Prey,
too,
you know, right? A feeding bite, exactly. You know, and I do think you're right to point out, to highlight that, like, a feeding bite is different than a combatant bite or a copulatory bite in terms of what that usually looks like.
Totally.
Well.
Well, yeah, thank you. This other, is fun. I think there are great points, you know, to all sides here.
I hope so. Yeah,
it's been great talking to you, man.
Oh, yeah. It's always great talking to you guys. Again, I would just clarify that most of the first half was not real. I go have a lot.
No, we want a strong advocate. Often I feel like I don't stick to the format enough, right? I break the fourth wall on this stuff too much. So I love the
hit
love
me,
the,
Rob. Sorry, that was too much.
We've been accused of being reptile love club instead of reptile fight club. There's no fighting that usually, you know, real fighting that goes on. But I mean, I do think there are a lot of good, you know, points that were brought up on both sides that, you know, you need to be aware of. And I think that's the purpose of the show, is to show it from both sides. We don't have anybody coming in here saying you only cohabitate or you never cohabitate. You know, it's a mix, and that's any topic. If somebody believes that one topic is completely one-sided, then they probably don't understand it, you know, and that's kind of what we're bringing out here. And, you know, yeah, we do break the fourth wall. We maybe entice people in, see, ooh, Reptile Fight Club. I want to watch people duking it out. But in reality, you know, there's very few Duke Fests that go on here.
There's been a few.
Yeah. Well, some I've just rolled over and given up because I couldn't gain control. But, you know, that's a different matter. So, yeah, I have one in mind. Yeah, we do like to see both sides. We do like to see kind of from both perspectives. And I do, you know, I'm trying to think. We might have talked about cohabitation on one of the previous shows, but I think
it feels like you probably have. Yeah.
But these topics are
topical. Yeah,
deep enough. And I think. Yeah, different perspectives and different insights and experiences. So I think that's kind of what this is all about. And I think, you know, we find ourselves as keepers discussing the same topics a lot too. And we can learn new things and change our perspective and say, oh, I'm never going to do that again. Or, oh, how did I not think of this? You know, so that's kind of what we're aiming for. And hopefully listeners got that from this show. And I thought there's some really cool points brought up, and yeah, thanks for to both of you for battling it out.
thank you both.
Yeah. You need a name for your alter ego there, Lucas.
Oh,
no, right.
Leakus Lou or something.
Lucas P.
Watch out for that Leakus Lou. He's a scrapper.
He's a rotten bastard. Yeah.
Well, where can people find you and see the cool things you're up to?
Yes. Centralian Exotics is my reptile pseudonym. You can find me there. www.centralianexotics.com. The same name on Instagram and Facebook. That's it.
Listen to
him. Carpets and Coffee. Yeah.
Is it Monday?
Every other Monday.
Yeah.
Yeah. Every other Monday.
From Friday to Monday because you guys had a life and wanted to go do things on Friday.
They keep using that as the excuse, but I don't know. I don't know if it was really my life. No. Yeah. Yes. And we don't stick to the schedule very well, but it is, it's extracurriculars.
Yeah. For it's a all fun involved. Hangout show too, and you can watch it live, get on YouTube, make comments.
Yes,
you
know,
it's a really fun show, so I enjoy it. I try to get on there when I remember it's on. I'm old.
Always love when we see you in there.
So, yeah, it's fun to get on and poke the bear, you know, make fun of Owen or something.
Yes, the bear is Owen.
And if it's too off the wall, they just ignore you, so it works out.
Yeah. So thank you so much for having me, and I love this show and I listen to it a lot.
Well, we appreciate it. We enjoy it when we can bring people on who listen and understand what we're going for and have some, you know, good points of view. So I'm sure we'll have you back. And again, I apologize. We didn't have you on earlier. So
that's all right. If any of the listeners were finding themselves just, you know, really hating my voice, like they just really like that guy's got a punch in the face voice, like challenge me, let's go. I'll fight you. I'll fight anyone on the internet from safe distance.
Oh,
About reptile topics.
With Justin to hold my hand.
Those old stories of like the old reptile shows where different personalities would get together and actually fight, you know, because they they hated each other's perspectives or the way they were doing stuff. And yeah, good times.
Yeah.
Well, I guess we won't get into those stories on here, but maybe for another show. All right. Well, any cool herpetological things you've seen over the last week, or anything neat that you've seen recently in regards to herp life? I kind of mentioned that video and seeing, you know, I just making me itch to get out to herp again. I need to get out there. I guess I have some trips coming up fairly soon, so I'm excited for that.
Oh man. Yeah. I feel like there has to have been, for the super dorks out there, there was a really good, PBS Eons video on YouTube that talked about elapids and the like history of how everything else on the planet had to evolve to them having venom. So that was a really good one that I enjoyed as someone that doesn't keep venomous or, you know, do much with that side of things. It was a pretty fascinating little video. So I'd recommend people go watch that.
That is neat. PBS puts out some good programs. I was watching one the other week on whales.
And, nice.
They were doing a necropsy on a whale, and they were pulling out the stomach, and it's got chambers. Like it's like a cow, you know, how they have.
Well, they used to be hoofstock.
Chambered stomachs. Yeah. And they evolved from like a common ancestor of
indeed. They just moved into the ocean and never left.
Exactly. And I told that to some of my colleagues in the agricultural university, you know, and that work with livestock, and they didn't know that cows had chambered stomachs, just like their cows and, you know, sheep and stuff. So that was kind of cool to learn something interesting about that. I just love those nature documentaries. That's my favorite.
Totally. Me too. Yeah. The Eon shorts are always very entertaining, and, you know, it's everything from natural history to hominid stuff and everything in between. So it's cool.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Yep. Well, tell you Aussies out there, keep those herp videos coming onto YouTube. I could do without the music choices sometimes. Like, I don't know what it is, but it just rubs me the wrong way.
Got your Muzzin over there.
Yeah, it's the Muzzin way. I guess I need more rock music or something.
He needs some Taylor Swift.
Yeah, apparently that's what everything but electronica sounds like to Nipper is Taylor Swift. So, well, I guess she rules the world for a reason, you know, controlling our elections and calling the Super Bowls, you know, it's all Taylor Swift.
I believe
it. Good times. All right. Well, thanks for, joining us here, and thanks for listening to another episode of Reptile Fight Club. We'll see you again next week.